The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy. Green tea or parsley for bad breath. Question. You may have some readers who would like to know about eliminating breath odors. A simple and inexpensive way to do this is to nibble on parsley leaves, fresh or dried. I learned this from a coworker who fortified himself with a shot of gin before meetings. He then nibbled on parsley from a tin he kept next to his bottle to eliminate the smell. I tried his trick after I developed a sore throat and ate garlic sandwich to ward it off. I didn't want to lose a day of work, but everyone who came into the office commented on the garlic smell and followed their noses to my cubicle. I was startled by the accusations. My coworker saved the day by pouring a liberal amount of parsley flakes into my hand and telling me to eat it like a rabbit. In no time, the whole staff settled down to work. Answer. Although parsley is popular, we couldn't find any evidence that it reduced the sulfur compounds responsible for bad breath. Surprisingly, however, green tea has a short-term effect on these chemicals, and that's cited in the Journal of Nutritional Science and Vitaminology, February 2008, and the Dental Research Journal, November to December 2018. So, the next time you need to suppress bad breath for a little while, consider sipping and swishing a cup of green tea. Question. When you think about supplementing vitamin D, your first choice should be sunshine, the most natural source. Vitamin D by itself isn't calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and iron. Also are necessary, along with vitamins A and K. Answer. We love sunshine as a source of vitamin D, but there are circumstances when the sun exposure isn't practical. During the winter in most of the northern states, it's too cold and there isn't enough sun to get vitamin D from sunshine on the skin. Even in the summertime, some people take medications that make them susceptible to sunburn. People with skin cancer must use sunscreen. They block vitamin D formation. There is still room for vitamin D supplements. We discuss dosing, signs of low vitamin D, and home tests for vitamin D levels in our guide to vitamin D deficiency. Anyone who would like a copy, contact peoplespharmacy.com. PPI, or proton pump inhibitors, for GERD makes kidney disease worse. Question. My family doctor prescribed Prilosec, and I took it for several years. I quit taking it after I read that PPIs are associated with hip fractures. Then I read your article about a link between PPIs and kidney problems. I had been off the drug for at least a year when I had blood work done. I was told I was in stage 3 kidney failure. I have no risk factors for kidney disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, etc. For 2 years, my kidney function remained stable. Then in July of last year, my GERD was so bad that I went to a gastroenterologist who did an endoscopy. She asked me why I had quit taking Prilosec. I told her about the kidney failure, and she said PPIs do not cause it. She then prescribed a low dose of Protonix and said it should not affect my kidneys. My family doctor checked my kidney function 3 months later, and it had declined. I then saw a nephrologist, and he said I should never take any PPIs again. He said Pepcid is okay, so I now take Pepcid AC. I tell everyone I know who takes PPIs about the risk of kidney problems. Answer, thank you for sharing your story. It illustrates the problem of healthcare specialists in silos that may not interact very much. The evidence that acid-suppressing drugs like proton pump inhibitors can damage the kidneys is well established. In addition, there is evidence that continued use of PPIs may make existing kidney disease worse. Pepcid AC belongs to a different category of medication that has not been associated with harm to the kidneys. You will find 10 questions asked when you get a prescription in our book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. They should help you overcome the silo effect and avoid medication problems. The book is available in your library or online at www.peoplespharmacy.com. Question, I take lisinopril for high blood pressure. I know I should avoid extra potassium. Are there any other vitamins or minerals I should watch out for? Answer. Potassium is the most important. Too much potassium can be just as dangerous as too little. So you should be careful not to take supplemental potassium or use potassium salt substitutes. ACE inhibitors like lisinopril deplete the body of zinc. Ask your doctor to monitor your zinc status so you will know if you need a supplement. From the Wall Street Journal, How to Find Help for Depression and Suicide. And this is by Elizabeth Bernstein. In my column, I write regularly about how to help someone who is depressed or even suicidal. I receive many emails from readers who are worried about a loved one and seeking advice. Many people say they are desperate for answers and don't know where to turn next. I explain to those who write that I am not a medical professional, so I'm not qualified to answer questions about specific information or questions about specific situations. But I encourage them not to give up hope. It's important to stay close to someone who is suffering from depression or who may be suicidal, even if that person tries to push you away. Here are some resources that can help. A person who is depressed needs professional help. A good place to start is the person's primary care physician, who can determine if there are physiological factors at play and who can make a referral to a psychiatrist or a medical doctor who can diagnose mental illness and prescribe medicine, or a psychologist or licensed mental health professional for therapy. Insurance companies will have lists of providers who are covered by their plans. The American Psychiatric Association, www.psychiatry.org, has a physician locator on the website, as well as much information about psychiatric disorders. The American Psychological Association, www.apa.org, has a therapist finder and offers many resources for people seeking help for themselves or someone else. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a type of therapy that helps people adjust their thoughts to be more positive. The Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, www.abct.org, has a therapist finder and more information. I recently wrote about dialectical behavior therapy, which specifically targets suicidal thoughts rather than the underlying depression or illness. Research shows it is effective at reducing suicidal thoughts. BehavioralTech.org, www.behavioraltech.org, and the DBT-Linehan, L-I-N-E-H-A-N, Board of Certification, www.dbt-lbc.org, have more information and offer therapist finders on their websites. Finally, here is the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, www.suicidepreventionlifeline.org, 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-8255. It is important to make sure that anyone who may be suicidal has this number and is encouraged to call it. The helpline can also be a good resource for someone who is concerned about a loved one and is seeking advice. The Wall Street Journal, Heard on the Street, The Side Effects of Million-Dollar Drugs, by Charlie Grant. Gene therapies will bring hope for patients and opportunities for investors as long as someone is willing to pay for them. It's only a matter of time until the first million-dollar drug arrives in a deeply dysfunctional healthcare system. With the new drugs come painful questions. Who is stuck with the bill? Do they have the cash to pay it, and how can they avoid the obligation? The age of gene therapy promises a wave of life-changing and life-saving medicine. Some have been approved, like Luxturna from Spark Therapeutics, which treats a hereditary disease that causes blindness and affects roughly 2,000 patients in the U.S. Roche agreed to buy the company recently for 1.5 times its previous market value, in large part for some promising treatments for hemophilia. There are nearly 300 gene therapies under development, aiming to treat more than 100 diseases. according to a recent report from a drug industry trade group. Wall Street expects gene therapy drugs could generate billions in annual revenue in the near future. These treatments carry high price tags because they are expensive to develop and often bring large benefits to a fairly small patient pool. For example, Luxturna carries a list price of $425,000 per eye before rebates and discounts. That isn't out of line for a drug that can give the gift of sight. In other cases, a seemingly exorbitant treatment might cure an illness that would cost more to treat over time with older maintenance drugs. Yet the U.S. healthcare system isn't designed to handle large one-time payments. Public insurers like Medicare and Medicaid can't pay a large bill in installments under current rules, which makes reimbursing the cost of this type of medicine a challenge. The situation with private insurers is challenging too, but for different reasons. Roughly half of Americans get health insurance from their employers, but the median time workers stay with an employer is 4.2 years, according to the Labor Department. If the insurance company expects to cover the patient for a lifetime, that decision would be fairly simple. If it expects to cover a patient for only 4 years, however, the calculus changes. Why should I pay today so my competitor or Medicare, if the patient is nearing retirement, can receive the long-run benefits? Other factors like the novelty of gene therapy add to the risk an insurer faces. Who foots the next bill if the gene therapy stops being effective in, say, 10 years? The arrival of gene therapy is either a perfect storm or a perfect opportunity to better align health care spending with value provided to patients, says Robert DeBoy, Chief Medical Officer of the National Pharmaceutical Council, a health policy research organization funded by the drug industry. One potential solution to the problem created by patients switching insurers could be forming a new shared risk pool of patients or gene therapy, which minimizes the insurer's incentive to take a short-term view on costs. Drug makers are working on solutions as well. Spark has offered rebates to health plans if the drug fails to do what it promises over the long term. Spark also has submitted a proposal to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that would allow for installment payments. Those efforts have led to some modest success. Sales of Luxturna reached about $27 million in 2018. Its fourth quarter sales of $10 million were the highest on record. But drugs like Luxturna, which have approval to treat only a small number of patients, won't seriously stress the healthcare system. Dr. DeBoer notes that would change if a therapy aimed at a larger patient population, such as sickle cell anemia or type 1 diabetes, were to reach the market. That could lead to billions in payments in just a few years, stressing insurers, Medicare and Medicaid. Bigger bills aren't very far off. Analysts expect a Novartis gene therapy treatment for spinal muscular atrophy, which hasn't yet reached the market, to generate $1.7 billion in sales by 2023. Novartis said at its investor day last year it believes the drug is cost-effective at a price tag of $4 million to $5 million per patient. $4 million to $5 million per patient. Other drugs in development by smaller companies are expected to achieve similar sales over that time frame. Given the long lead times in drug development, tens of billions of dollars in market value is predicted on insurers covering gene therapies under development in much the same way that today's medicines are. The perfect opportunity to rethink how medicine is paid for is here, but should that be squandered, patients, insurers, investors, drug makers, and the government could end up in a bitter battle over who will pay for these medical breakthroughs. Is surgery needed for breast cancer? And again, this is the Wall Street Journal Health by Lucette Legnato. When Sabrina Jones was diagnosed with aggressive breast cancer, she expected to have surgery to remove the tumor and her entire breast. My first instinct was get it out, get the cancer out, Ms. Jones said. But the 52-year-old manager at an educational tech company responded so well to chemotherapy, her surgeon at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston informed her that the cancerous tumor was completely gone. He asked her to participate in an experiment in which she skipped surgery altogether. The trial is part of a movement known as de-escalation, which aims to do less in medicine. For decades, aggressive treatment such as surgery was the norm in cancer care. In a striking departure, breast surgeons today say they can operate less and achieve similar results. Now some are investigating not operating at all. If you get biopsy proof of no residual disease, an important research question is, do you need to do surgery, says Larry Norton, a breast cancer specialist and senior vice president at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. That we are learning to accomplish the same with less is a very exciting point in the field. Dr. Norton, an oncologist, said doing without surgery needs to be tested, but it is a potential milestone in breast cancer treatment. For a long time, the approach had been radical mastectomies, which remove the breast and underlying muscle, or mastectomies, which removed only the breast. That started to change in the late 1980s with the advent of lumpectomies, operations where just the tumor and some surrounding tissue were removed, followed by radiation. In 2015, 65.5% of breast cancer patients aged 20 or older in the United States had breast-conserving surgeries, and 34.4% had mastectomies, according to the National Cancer Institute. The no-surgery notion has struck some doctors as a logical next step in de-escalation. Ms. Jones decided in August to take part in the no-surgery clinical trial at MD Anderson, but found the prospect nerve-wracking. I had to wrap my brain around the fact that the cancer was gone and there was nothing left to remove, she said. It is scary because it was not the traditional protocol in which a surgeon follows chemotherapy with an operation and radiation to make sure no cancer remains. As drugs have become more effective, there are times when surgeons reach a tumor site and find nothing. In those cases, they remove tissue to make sure the area around the site is cancer-free. Some doctors say it may be possible to skip surgery altogether, sparing the patients the risk of general anesthesia as well as the pain and scars that operations can bring. In the MD Anderson trial, doctors check to see if the area is indeed cancer-free by scanning the breast using mammograms, ultrasound, or an MRI, and then doing a precise biopsy with a needle. The patient is monitored with annual mammograms as well as imaging tests every 6 months for 5 years. Henry Kuerer, K-U-E-R-E-R, the MD Anderson surgeon leading the trial, says he and others hope to enroll 50 women. About 20 of them will have surgery, the rest will skip it. The non-surgery course is open only to women with certain types of breast cancer that respond completely to drug treatment. He hopes his trial will show it is safe to spare women the operation. I would be ecstatic if all of us surgeons would be put out of business, he says. The National Cancer Institute is sponsoring a preliminary trial of the no-surgery approach at several sites for patients with breast cancer requiring chemotherapy. The trial will look at whether a needle biopsy, a non-surgical procedure done on the breast area where the tumor was, can determine if a woman has no cancer left after chemotherapy and may avoid surgery. It will involve 175 women in Canada and the U.S. and could lead to a paradigm change in the treatment of breast cancers, the NCI said, National Cancer Institute said. De-escalation of surgery is happening. said Dr. Sheldon Feldman, chief of breast surgery at Montefiore Health System in New York. Dr. Feldman has been involved in the NCI trial and said that as drugs have improved, medical therapy works better and the role of surgery is less and less. Despite the optimism, some physicians are wary. "We don't know that eliminating surgery is safe," says Eric Weiner, W-I-N-E-R, chief of the breast cancer program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. "Even when tumors have disappeared, it is possible. There are submicroscopic changes we can't detect," he said. "Thus far, for most patients, our drugs are not able to eradicate all of the cancer." While unlikely, foregoing surgery could place a woman at high risk of a breast cancer recurrence, Dr. Weiner said. "Besides, I think there are women who would prefer not to have such intensive screening of MRIs, biopsies, and mammograms," he said. "Sure enough, it has been tough to get some women to sign up for the nose surgery approach. It is not an easy sell," says Amelia Diego, a breast surgeon at UPMC McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh. That's the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's McGee Women's Hospital. Dr. Diego, who was participating in the MD Anderson trial, says, "Some women say it is a worthy cause, but I want to have an operation." The Mayo Clinic health letter, reducing salt intake, keeping flavor. Reducing sodium intake and eating a heart-healthy diet, which is often naturally low in sodium, are key parts of most plans to control high blood pressure, hypertension. Most plans also include taking a drug to lower blood pressure, but diet changes can sometimes delay the need for medication or reduce the amount of medication you need. Not everyone experiences reduced blood pressure with reduced sodium intake, but those most likely to experience it include older adults, African Americans, those with more severe hypertension, and those with diabetes or kidney disease. It's generally recommended that adults keep their daily sodium intake to 2,300 milligrams or less a day. That's the amount of sodium in 1 teaspoon of salt. Those with hypertension, kidney disease, heart failure, or certain other conditions may benefit from consuming less than that. Despite the recommendations, the average American female consumes about 300 milligrams daily, and the average American male consumes 4,200 milligrams daily. About 80% of that total comes from processed and restaurant foods. Your salt shaker or adding table salt in cooking can also contribute, but often it's not the main source. Saving flavor. You can cut back on sodium in your foods and drinks, but still keep outstanding flavor by eating minimally processed foods. Recommendations for a heart-healthy diet typically hit the mark for low sodium intake. This includes a diet focused on minimally processed plant foods such as fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts, seeds, and whole grains. Round that out with lean, unprocessed meats, healthy oils such as olive oil, and low-fat dairy products. Keep in mind, even a healthy food can be salted in processing. Look for unsalted versions of various products, such as unsalted nuts and cans of no salt added or low-sodium beans, tomato sauce, or vegetables. You can reduce some of the salt in canned goods, such as beans, by rinsing the product before eating. Minimize heavily processed foods. This includes canned or packaged soups, prepared dinners, pizza, pasta mixes, seasoning packets, certain breads, and other foods that are often high or very high in sodium. The same goes for snacks such as potato chips or pretzels, and cured or sodium-injected meat such as lunch meat, bacon, ham, hot dogs, and rotisserie chicken. Reading labels. The nutrition facts label will tell you how much sodium is in a serving of food. Choose foods that have less than 200 milligrams of sodium per serving. Getting creative with flavors? Use herbs, spices, citrus juice, vinegar, and hot sauce to add pop to your foods, whether during cooking or at the table. There are many salt-free herb and spice blends available, and there are many recipes for homemade blends. With any product, check the label for salt content, as some, such as lemon pepper, can be very high in sodium. Salt substitutes, which are often a mix of salt and potassium chloride, should be used sparingly, if at all, particularly if you have kidney disease. Tasting before salting. Be open to flavors that aren't salt-enhanced. In addition, think before adding condiments such as ketchup, soy sauce, salad dressings, and mustard, as these can be very salty. Look for lower sodium versions of these products, and even then use sparingly. Being smart while dining out, considering a side of fresh fruit rather than french fries. Look for restaurants that feature fresh foods, low sodium options, and sodium information on menus. Low sodium cooking. Cooking from basic ingredients can help you avoid the high levels of sodium in more processed foods. Try the recipe below for a low sodium creamy wild rice soup. A typical can or mix of creamy wild rice soup contains 800 milligrams or more of sodium per 1 cup serving. This recipe contains about 70 milligrams per cup. The recipe gets its creaminess from blended beans, keeping fiber content high and unhealthy fat content low. So here's an example. Cream of wild rice soup. The ingredients: 1.5 cups of diced yellow onion, 1 cup of diced carrot, 1 cup of diced celery, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 1/2 tablespoon canola oil, 1 1/2 cups of diced kale, 1 tablespoon minced parsley, 2 cups reduced sodium vegetable stock, 1 teaspoon fennel seeds, 1 teaspoon black pepper, 1 cup unsalted white beans prepared, 2 cups 1% milk, and 1/2 cup of wild rice cooked. And then saute the onion, carrot, celery, and garlic in canola oil in a soup pot until lightly brown. Add kale, parsley, stock, and spices in a blender. Puree beans with milk. Add bean mixture to soup. Bring to simmer and add rice. Cook for 10 minutes. The nutritional analysis per 2 cup serving: 229 calories, 5 grams of total fat, 1 gram saturated, 6 milligrams of cholesterol, 135 milligrams of sodium, 35 grams of total carbs, and 7 grams of dietary fiber, 11 grams of protein. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.